Welcome to Shifting Power Through Feminisms, a podcast series born from the African Feminisms Gathering held in Johannesburg in September 2025. Over 4 days, feminists from across the continent and across generations came together through ritual, art, activism, and dialogue to reimagine power, challenge injustice, and build futures grounded in care, creativity, and collective strength. This podcast doesn't recount the gathering. It continues its conversations. In the 3 episodes, we explore how African feminists are responding to a time of polycrisis, how well-being and healing shape sustainable movements, and how men can engage meaningfully as allies in feminist struggles. These episodes carry forward the spirit of the gathering's core themes: rights, representation, and resources, while inviting listeners into the ongoing work of shifting power through feminisms. So let's keep the conversation moving.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the second part of our discussion on African feminisms and the polycrisis. This is part of conversations that have been hosted by the Goethe Institute under the House of African Feminisms Project. And today again, I am happy to have Brenda Wamboi with me to continue our discussion on African feminisms and our thoughts on the polycrisis. So thank you, Brenda.
Can you introduce yourself again? Yeah, actually, let's do another. You'd also need to introduce yourself. Round of intros in case this is where someone is, you know, finding us in the middle of the conversation. My name is Brenda Wamboi. Marilyn has, you know, taught me to introduce myself as a political strategist as well. I'm a political scientist, a Kenyan feminist, and a lover of African people. Currently, I didn't talk about what I'm doing now. I'm building a policy institute / think tank. So hopefully coming out of stealth mode next year. That's 2026. A person who's interested in opportunities that we can take as African people, as African feminists, to further our cause and expand our rights, expand our scope, you know, of action and empower ourselves. Yeah, so that's why we're here, or that's why I'm here.
Thank you, Brenda. So I love speaking with you.
Me too.
Because I love the politics part of your brain and the policy and you just the range.
Thank you.
So I'm also a Kenyan feminist. I am a lawyer by training. I'm a writer. I am a researcher, but I think right now I just want to be a writer. I'm going to keep saying that until the universe responds with a published book or two. So this conversation is part two, as I have said. And in part one, we talked about, you know, the narrative of the polycrisis. We talked about the range and the intersectionality of the policy crisis. And so today I'm thinking we talk about what next, you know. So now that we live in this state of permanent crisis, what now, what next? How do African feminists and how do Africans navigate this world?
Yeah, so I think I'm going to use an anecdote that I deployed on another podcast I recorded last week, but just to give people a sense of hope, because this is how I look at it. It's similar like when you live in a house, if you don't live by yourself, right, you live with people, there's always going to be an ongoing conversation about stuff, right?
Yes.
So, Marilyn, I've done the dishes the last 3 days. You've said you are going to do the dishes on Friday, but then you didn't. And then you'll tell me like, oh no, it's because I was busy. Like I had to do, you know, so it's an ongoing conversation about how you and I are going to share the house and who does what. Now you expand that to society, for example, or not even a society, a community, right? So it's you and your 20 neighbors. And it's so-and-so did this with the garbage, so-and-so hasn't paid. Then I expand that again. You expand it to the point where you have, like in Kenya, for example, you have counties. In some other countries, you have states, you know. And so it's a never-ending conversation about who does what, who has what power. And so when you look at it like that, like, do we ever get to a place where we finished?
No.
Right?
Yeah.
So the politics will never stop. For as long as you're not one person, right? You're not the one person living on the planet, in the country, it never stops.
Yeah.
So once you think about it like that, I think initially it can be tiresome because it's like, oh no, no, even when you think about it, like every 5 years you're gonna, in Kenya, you're gonna have an election.
Yes.
Every 5 years, you can't get a break, you know?
Yep.
So yeah, it's a national conversation on that level, every 5 years. On a macro, that's the macro level. On a micro level, it's these small things, like what we care about as Kenyans, what do we care about, mm-hmm. as feminists, what do we care about? So it's never ending. And so you could allow that to knock the wind out your sails, or you could use it as something
yes.
empowering, right? So for me, mm-hmm. I choose to look at it in a very empowering fashion. So if the crisis, as you've said, it's a state in which we've existed. We spoke about this at length in the first half of the conversation. So if this state of crisis is what has become the new normal, what do we do within it, right? So mm-hmm. how do we respond? Because I refuse, personally, I refuse to take that like really resigned, nihilistic, mm-hmm. powerless kind of, you know, approach to things. I'm like, yeah, we always have the power, and especially as a collective.
Right.
So I think that's where we start, right? Like as a collective. And the easiest place, I'm not saying it's simple, eh? But the easiest place to start is an understanding of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what you're doing, listening to this or watching this podcast, framing, like getting,
yes.
you know, who says what, who does what, and understanding things on a systemic level. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to look at individual behavior. Like something I am over, I've been over for a really long time, is hyper-focus on individuals, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it's like people act the way they act mostly because systems incentivize that behavior.
Right.
Yeah. The system is incentivizing you to move like that. So it's easier. You're just mm-hmm. going with the flow. So having systemic analysis, understanding feminist theory, and what was happening when that theory was being developed, right? So it's not just they said this and this and this and then
right.
touting it, you know, as gospel. It's mm-hmm. what was the, like,
context.
The context around which those statements were made. And a history of resistance movements in mm. general, mm-hmm. right? So we are Kenyan, so there's a very hallowed place where we hold resistance movements, like the Mau Mau, for example. That's the Kenya Land and Freedom Army, and you know, the second liberation in the 90s, like, you know, just very yes. hallowed.
Yeah.
But then those were popular movements by people, right? So there were right. people yeah. just like us.
Yeah.
So how did they do what they were doing? What were mm-hmm. the pitfalls of those movements? What were the challenges they encountered? And also understanding like political economy. How does politics move mm-hmm. things? Yeah, and not outside of the electoral cycles in whatever yes, country you yes. are in, right? So fine, you have an election. In Kenya, that's in 2027. What's been happening between the one that happened in 2022 and 2027? What mm-hmm. are the conversations that we've been having?
Right.
How have our politics moved? How we experience reality, right? Mm-hmm. In Kenya, for example, last year, things were bad enough that Kenyans took to the streets. This year, we took to the streets again, not just because of the finance bill, but because of state violence. Those are, you know, manifestations of existing political economy and understanding how power works.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Understanding how power works. And you are a political subject. You're not a thing that politics happens to, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. You are a subject of politics and you can be an actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about how politics moves, and I'm sure Maylin can share more about this, like how power moves within the political system, a singular person like the president of Kenya, for example, can act by himself. Yeah. Right. By himself is a very powerful actor. Brenda Wambui by herself, not a match for the president yes. of Kenya. But then mm-hmm. Brenda Wambui and 2 million other Kenyans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. then the president of Kenya as a political actor has to listen. So looking at ways that we can pull these levers, right?
Yeah.
How do we meet the system? How do we meet the state? How do we counteract when they act in ways that go, you know, run counter to our interests as people. So those are just my initial thoughts. I'm sure more will come out.
Okay.
Yeah.
I really like that we are both political subjects and political actors and beyond the electoral cycle.
Yes.
I think, you know, with the rise in electoral authoritarianism, which everyone is starting to understand now because of the classic example of the United States.
Yes.
We're starting to understand that elections can be subverted. I mean, as Africans, we know, we can tell you, we've been yes. there, done that, worn the t-shirt, right? But I think that one of the things that this moment offers us is permission in a way to disengage from electoral politics, mm. which I think is very threatening to the state. I think that's what protests yes. do, right? Protests are an understanding that, okay, you've decided that you're going to concentrate power in that way and act in that way, despite and in spite of my my thoughts, my expressed you know, positions, and so I'm going to respond in this way.
Mm.
And it is really helpful, I think, for us to move ourselves from this space of just being a citizen into being political subjects and actors. So I do think that that's a very helpful lens with which to view the poly crisis. And I suspect also it means an enormous amount of unlearning for many of us, doesn't it? Because, you know, if I've been thinking of myself as, you know, I'm just a good citizen, I pay my taxes, I do what I'm supposed to do, I drive on the right side of the road most of the time, you know. Suddenly now you're forcing me to ask myself questions, and you're making the work of citizenship political. Is everyone going to be able to do that?
It's a really hard ask, right? And normally, if things were working the way we envisioned they would work, right? When we think about how we've set up our, like, we'll talk about Kenya because that's, you know, that's what I know well. How we've set up our states, we have a representative democracy. We've decided that some people are going to go and represent us because the full-time work of reading all those bills, getting educated, talking to people, it's a lot, right? So we want to be able to do other things, and we say, okay, we're going to elect you, Marilyn, to go to the National Assembly or to go to Senate and represent us in this manner, right? But then now, if you send Marilyn or you send Brenda and Brenda isn't doing what she's supposed to do, you know, you find yourself in a pickle. Now you're the one who has to read those bills. You have to understand. You have to call the neighbors. You have to organize. You have to say, we're going to say no. We're going to go and picket outside of parliament. So you're finding yourself in this position because something has gone wrong in this process that you designed or in the system that you designed, right? So it's an indicator. Now we are past early warning lights. We are past canaries in the coal mine. As we are in critical failure, I think, right? So I think the thing about a system that's failing is it also offers more opportunities for, like, you know, people who want to try something new, people who want to try something different, right? Okay. So it's the people who watched Game of Thrones. Remember that chaos is a ladder, right? Like you could stay, you could sit there and cry, or you could, I think this kind of environment where, you know, we don't know, you know, if up is down, up is up, that kind of thing, offers us an opportunity as citizens to decide. And in this case, because we're looking at it from an African feminist lens, right?
Yes.
So as African women, what opportunities does this present us? You know, do we get to make an argument? You know, if we want to be a bit chaotic, we could say that this is where the leadership of the men has brought us. You know what I mean? Try something different. But we know better because we know that systems have incentivized the same men as well, not only like patriarchal systems, but others, right?
Right.
So we'd have to imagine just a reimagination of systems, more or less reworking from ground up. Like throughout the things that don't work. And I think this is something that you have spoken about before, we've spoken about in a conversation, not just reform, right? Like the abolition. So sometimes when we speak about abolition, I think a lot of people come across abolition as a movement from the whole abolish the police, abolish the state. And it sounds a bit drastic, but basically abolitionism, and it's a very basic description, is this thing is not working. You know, throw it out. Throw it out.
And then it's often linked to anarchy, right?
Yes.
Which we saw a lot during the protests, where the response wasn't, oh, let's reform the system so it works.
Yes.
It's these people want to make sure there is no system, right? And it's like, no one was saying we don't want a system. We were saying we want a system that works, that meets our needs. So I think it's important, as you're saying, to notice the use of the terms and then maybe ask the question, okay, and then what? Because often the people who are doing that advocacy know the and then what. You may not, but they do, right?
Yeah, and it's also a struggle normally by the state to take charge of the framing, right? Because what you've done is you've achieved or had a major framing victory. So they're like, these are a bunch of anarchists. And my kind of chaotic opinion is, and then what's wrong with the anarchists anyway? You know,
right.
Like if the system is not working, is it so absurd to say that it should be should be tossed out?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I tend to think about, and this is just, you know, political science indoctrination. I love the concept of the Overton window because it captures that we are permanently in a state of conversation. So I want you to imagine for the viewers, imagine like on this end and on this end, we have, you know, two ends and then we have a little square in the middle and that's your window of political opportunity. So this side keeps trying to pull it this way. This other side keeps trying to pull it this way. And that's how most of our victories politically have been won. When you think about women's rights. It's making it an acceptable conversation, because politicians, in general, I keep telling people, are not leaders. They are followers.
Yes. Yeah?
They are followers. So you have to say that this is something we are discussing. And then the politician is like, fine, fine. They keep asking. Therefore, we are going to discuss it. And then over time, it becomes a thing that is a societal conversation. Like, should women have this? Should queer people have this? Should, you know? And then now we get to, as a society, revisit or visit that, and then now have new views, right? Yep. And then we always, and then it becomes like, we always supported women. We were always pro-women.
Right.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the people who know, the people who are pulling the window on both sides, you know, the people who are engaged in these framing wars or framing battles, the likes of us.
Yes.
Yeah, they can tell you different. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's how I look at it. I'm like, it's a permanent state of conversation. So as African feminists, we can say that now the time has come, right?
Yes.
We must address, which is what we've said, for example, we must address femicide as a manifestation of violence against women on the African continent.
Right.
Yeah. And then we end up learning from each other. So even when we think about the origin of total shutdown, that originated in South Africa.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Total shutdown as a movement, as a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then that was adopted in other, because in Kenya, we also had total shutdown.
And Uganda.
Right?
Yes.
So we ended up having total shutdown in multiple countries as modeled by South African feminists. So for me, those are the political opportunities. Now it is a it is a perfectly acceptable thing to have a conversation on femicide in Kenya.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
This when we started the conversation in 2019, it was a fringe conversation. It was a fringe movement.
Yes.
Right? So we've seen this happen, and we can keep doing this with multiple, like even in Kenya, like it was unheard of, unthought of even. The way I keep telling people, Kenyans en masse on the streets saying the president must go. Oh, wow. Never heard about it. You know, never heard of anything like that. And yet, here we are. Yeah. So there are multiple opportunities, I'd say.
And I think it's interesting when you say that there are multiple opportunities. I think it's also reminding us that progress isn't necessarily, it's not going to be a moment of progress. Things that were unimaginable before become imaginable now, right? And then you live through it and it's a blip. And it's like, wait a second, we just, you know, I keep saying one of the problems with this polycrisis is every moment feels historic, you know? Like, do you remember there was a time we were talking about, this is unprecedented?
Yes.
We almost never hear that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, we just got tired.
Who uses that word anymore?
You know?
Yeah, yes. We're living in interesting times. Actually, I never want, if I had the opportunity as a child, like to be given a choice, and they were like, do you want to, I never want to live in interesting times. You know, I want to live in boring times, predictable times, where nothing interesting happens. Like, if only I knew.
If you only know, you knew,
this
right?
This is the life of, you know, adventure that I was signing up for. Something that a feminist told me, her name is Shelja Patel, who told me about, at some point, I think it was 2017, 18, when I was in another fit of despondency. And she asked me to imagine a spiral. So I want you to imagine a spiral, like it starts, but it's not like a uniform spiral, right? So it starts small, and then each time it goes up, it expands. Yep. So it keeps expanding. So the movement, every time you revisit the conversation, you might feel like, oh, we are back here again.
Yes,
we're having the same conversation. But it's not the same conversation. It's not the same people. It's more people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at it from like an aerial point of view, you'd see that it's expanding.
Right.
But because you're living it, you know, you're living it as it's coming, as it's coming and going, you tend to feel like it's the same thing over and over again, and yet it's not, right?
And yet it's
so there's progress because it's expanding. The spiral keeps on expanding.
Yes.
Yeah, capturing more people.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like between that and my overturn window, those are the things that, those are my drugs of choice in this political science.
And this moment does chosen, require.
Yeah, because it's never the same people, and we are always capturing more. Like there are opinions I hear younger women holding that they've come to accept as a given that when we were saying them in 2010, they wanted to burn us at the stake like witches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like how dare those witches imagine that women can have an opinion on Twitter.com.
Mm-hmm. How dare you say that men in the National Assembly represent women.
Yeah.
Women are represented by women's representatives, you know? And it's true, you know, in this short span of time, they are opinions and they're held also by people who you would never have thought.
Yeah.
Right. And sometimes they even articulated it, and you can almost see that language is like, that's Brenda's language.
Yeah.
Or
I love that. You know, I love that. It's usually one of the ways, like, yes, I entertain myself. I'm like, oh, mm-hmm, that's my framing. But yeah, you know, because we don't, the thing that we spoke about in the first half of the conversation, we're not here trying to be celebrity right, feminists, so waiting, yes, for people to clap for us, right? Like, we take our wins where we take them.
Yeah.
But then with the full knowledge that there's still way more to be done.
There's work to
and
be done.
If you join a movement or participate in any movement, mm-hmm, work waiting to be clapped for, my friend, you'll die a miserable death. So
and that we're building, yeah, on and with, we're both building on things that have happened before and work that has happened before. Mm. We're building with. I mean, I think, exactly, one of the things I love about the conversations is these African feminist conversations for me are in part to sort of solidify the ground, mm, you know, yeah, yeah, we did do that. Yeah, yeah, that did happen. But it's also to create the opportunity for an exchange that allows us to refine and, mm, you know, evolve in our own thinking as intellectuals, as public intellectuals, as you like to call us, mm, but also in terms of as a movement, yes, right? So, okay, so we're thinking of this as a spiral that we're even if we're having the same conversations multiple times, even if maybe we even use the example of protests. Mm-hmm. Even if you find yourself protesting, if you're new to protesting, you know, join the club. Some of us have been protesting for so long.
Yeah.
If you're new to protesting, it can feel like, wait a second, wasn't that protest supposed to yield a thing, mm-hmm, a very tangible thing? And oftentimes what protesting does is it makes everybody pay attention. It doesn't necessarily result in the kinds of change that a lot of people imagine, right? It doesn't do an immediate change. Like, yeah, for instance, you know, we watch the Nepalese with a little bit of envy.
And wistfulness. Like,
yes. Oh. Why not, mm, us, right? Like, when will it be our turn? And it will be our turn.
Yeah.
It will be our turn. But they don't always yield that. Mm-hmm. So it is to engage in things knowing that even if you're doing it again, you're also doing it again as a different person,
mm,
right?
Like, exactly.
I know a lot of people who went to the protest the first time expecting that it would fall. Okay, now you know I might need to be engaged in this longer, right? So there is a way you will engage that will be different.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage people not to think of that as failure.
Yes.
I think that's one of the other things that living in a state of crisis does to you is the state wants to frame any action that you take that doesn't result in immediate change as failure.
Yes.
As a way to, you know, create and basically feed that feeling of despondency, mm, and to keep you from thinking of yourself as this political actor.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're thinking about how then this crisis that we're living through is, and you spoke a little bit about this, but I do think it's helpful to talk about it a little more, how this crisis manifests in our bodies.
Yeah.
Because we talk about it as if it's this, and we've been talking about it, you know, mm, it happens out there. Not as if also it's happening in here,
yes,
right? And how does that manifest differently for different parts of our society? It's, I think the other thing about the poly crisis is it's not evenly distributed.
Yes.
Right? So how do we as African feminists then both recognize that, but how do we respond?
I think there has to be a concerted effort to take care of, like, as a political act, right? Mm. To take care of ourselves as a political act. Because if left up to its devices, the state will drive us all to death, right? Because people will keep having, like, they will always have citizens unless things go, yes, really wrong, right?
Yes.
So to the state, there's nothing special about Brenda. In fact, maybe she's a nuisance. So if she were to disappear, that would be such a tragedy, you know?
Right.
So for us, our continued existence, thriving, is an act of political resistance. And it's, mm-hmm, not to be, you know, woo-woo. It is, right?
Yeah.
We need people on the streets. We need people teaching people.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to take care of ourselves. And it is easy. Something that I find really diabolical is that it is easy for people to sink into really negative coping mechanisms. I think I mentioned substance use in the last episode, but I will touch on it again because it is quite easy, right?
Yeah, and prevalent.
Exactly. So we have to think about how we cope with the stress that we are dealing with,
mm-hmm,
and whether we're doing it productively. right? Are we dealing with this stress productively? People don't like hearing it, but I'm one of those people, so I'm one of those workout people, you know, start walking, take care of yourself, run. My friend, we have failing healthcare.
Yes.
This is not to absolve the state, but we have failing healthcare.
Yeah.
So what you can do for yourself, please try and do, right? Like the little you can do. For me, that's what I keep in mind. Left to its devices, the Kenyan government wouldn't even have an IV drip for me at a public hospital.
Yeah.
So, and we have to think of each other in that sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our neighbors' continued survival. And this conversation, I think we've had this conversation before on mutual aid. So mutual aid as a survival strategy, yes, 100% for me. Long term, I worry sometimes because I don't want the state coming under the impression, like in Kenya, the culture of Harambe, which is mutual aid at its finest, right?
Right, right.
Because we don't want our neighbors to die. We don't want our neighbors to be... to have their assets possessed by auctioneers. We don't want to, you know, so we step in. But then it allows the state, you know, like it has depoliticized us as actors to some extent.
Yeah.
And it allows the state to get off scot-free with this refusal to provide services, this rampant failure.
Yeah.
So for me, there's that, right? We have that duty to each other as neighbors, as co-citizens, etc., etc. But then we still have a duty to each other to hold that state accountable. So how do we... I think inject that political lens into the spaces we already occupy. Maylin brought up a really good point before we recorded about charmers. Charmers are, how do you, in South Africa, they're called stokvel, I think. These groups of women who come together, normally, you know, it'll be with, in Kenya, we'd say a merry-go-round. So usually, like, they'll donate money.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, yes, the money is needed for, you know, Maylin needs this, like, every month we give, like, I give 10,000 shillings, she gives 10,000, and we are maybe six other women. And every month that amount goes to one of the women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to pool resources or pool funding specifically for things that you want.
Yep.
But then in other instances, especially for women of upper classes, it's just an opportunity to build community, hang out, drink tea and eat samosas, and whatever else they like doing. And these are sites of, they can become sites of political action, right? Because women have that, like, muscle. Something else I was thinking about is that muscle that these kind of groups, right? Even your neighborhood, it maybe is for some of your very nosy neighbors to just know what's going on in other people's lives, but occasionally, like that group of your neighbors, that, like, that WhatsApp group etc. can become a tool, right, to mobilize and show up for each other, that we don't allow people to go, like, we haven't seen the neighbor from before in 2 weeks.
So
we know to either check in on them, you know, go knock on their door, or maybe they, you know, if they let someone know that they were traveling, that kind of thing. So we have to exercise that muscle where we care about each other, we humanize each other. And this is at the end of the day, right? Like, the feminist movement is fighting the dehumanization of women by the patriarchy, which, you know, is also like the polycrisis that we are experiencing is, you know, patriarchy meets capitalism, meets climate disaster, meets all these things, right? So exercising this muscle, right, where we are like, we are people and we deserve this kind of care is really important.
I think that is super, super important because, and I think because these groups already exist, I think one of the things is, one, participate in these groups. You know, like, don't see them as, oh, you know, I'm only 23. I don't need a chama, right? You need a community. And the more that we have community, the more likely we are to survive this sort of sustained bombardment against us as people. I think also when you talk about that, the thing I'm trying to connect it to the idea that you had about self-care and caring for ourselves, including our own healthcare and mental health as a political act. And maybe one of the other things is to talk about how can these chamas, these existing communities, even neighborhood groups, how can we convert them so that they are doing more that is health and mental health related, you know, even if it's going to be, you know, once a month, you guys, your neighborhood, you guys are doing a walk together, you know, and the idea is not the walk. The idea is that you're prompting each other about a physical health thing that matters to you. But also in that walk, you're able then to say, you know, we no longer have sidewalks, right?
Yes.
Like, I'm saying this and I don't know why. For some reason, I'm thinking of Woodley Estate, which has really been... Woodley Estate is an old estate in Nairobi that has been illegally acquired by the county government of Nairobi. Contrary to court orders. And in some cases, they've demolished houses. And it used to be one of those old... estates, man lived in by civil servants, yes. And you know, but lovely neighborhoods, space, you know, to play and walk and trees, you know, and I think it's emblematic again of what does a neighborhood group do, and for the most part, and we're speaking now about Kenya and in Nairobi in particular, I'm thinking, you know, there's just sort of that security function, right? We're yes. pooling resources to have the guy at the gate and maybe, you know, garbage collection because, oh my gosh, Nairobi yes, County does county not collect does not garbage, collect garbage yeah. despite the cost of living in Nairobi. So we're pooling resources to do the things that the government should be doing. And there was a time, I'm thinking, for instance, about the Karen Langata District Association. Mm-hmm. There is a case where they actually took Nairobi Water, I think, to court because they weren't providing water or garbage services. I can't remember. And essentially, they were suing. Mm. But these associations, we do need to think about reviving them. And we need to think about reviving them, not to be in battle with the state, because I think that had been the framing before. But I think for me, what I would say now is we need to think about reviving them as a means of our survival.
Yes.
That we are reclaiming public services and public assets for our own survival, right? We need garbage collection because we don't want people to get sick because, oh, by the way, you guys have a failing healthcare system,
yes.
right? So using these sites, and the reason for these sites is because they already exist. Because I think maybe, and we talked about this before, people imagine, oh, this movement, where's the office? Where do I go? It's not a political party. You know, you don't show up and you're given a job and, you know. So it's to say, what is it that I can do? How is it that I can participate that both permits progress for me as an individual, but also allows me to continue to survive.
Yes.
You know, I'm thinking of Toni Morrison and how she talks about, you know, sometimes you don't survive whole,
yes.
but the grandeur is in the attempt, right? That's not to say that, you know, some people are disposable, but it's to say that it will cost us to survive. The state has created the context where survival requires that we must engage in and in an oppositional fashion.
Yes.
And that's not our framing. That's not our choice. I mean, that is the choice of the state. So your job as a political actor or subject is to say, okay, where am I? What can I do? As we've talked about before. And who has placed me in this position?
Yes. So the power.
Yes.
Understanding
Again,
power. Yeah?
Understand the
These
power.
These are not just happening, my friend. Yeah. They're not just falling out of the sky.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
someone makes them happen.
Yeah.
People make them happen.
And so who's make? And you don't need to have an answer. Like, this is not a whodunit, right?
Yeah.
This is not a mystery. And I'm a great lover of mysteries. But it is the asking the question does two things. First of all, it puts power on notice that you have seen behind the veil, which is
yes.
extremely important. But it also means it's cued your mind to start paying attention to, oh, so-and-so doesn't experience that the same way I do. So suddenly you have a clue about, okay, so this is not something that everyone experiences
yes.
to the same extent, you know? And that's part of how African feminists think, you know, because we're in this space and we can be in a space of feminists. And then there's the, wait a second, I think I just said that. But because somebody who is from, you know, a majoritarian country has said that, that is heard differently. So
yes.
you start to then experience that inequality. And in that experience and in that noticing, you are doing political work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing that you've mentioned is really, really important, actually, in how to counter or how to, you know, how we act, right?
Mm-hmm.
While living in polycrisis. Something that's really key and why I'm really happy you made this happen for us is that we need to also root our analysis in our own realities,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
So, of course, people have eyes, so we can see that there's a problem, right? So
mm-hmm.
there's someone in the United Kingdom who's seen that the situation is untenable, someone else maybe in Malaysia, someone else in the United States, and so on and so forth. but we also can observe what's happening here, right, which is what we are doing. So another way that we flex this muscle or we insist that we matter is by rooting our analysis in what's happening on our continent, in our countries, in our societies. And it's also by insisting that this is unacceptable. So I really, let me tell you, the movements against femicide on the continent have really given me life because, it's we are not going to accept to die, African women.
Yes.
We are not going to accept to die. We're going to say that this responsibility lies with the state, which is true. Like, as we discussed in the last episode.
Yes.
Any violence that's happening, the state is aware, it's condoning it, it's incentivizing. The state is involved, Full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we then bring it to the state and say, women are dying. Why?
Yeah.
Yeah. We demand that you do something about it. And that also, something that Maylin speaks about a lot that I love is the role or the space for women as citizens.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. As citizens. Like, yes. Please. Yeah. And I love the framing of citizenship. It is not by virtue of how much tax you pay. It is not by virtue of your social class, your economic status, your education. By virtue of citizenship. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as a Kenyan woman, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You are entitled to all those things. Yeah. You go and read that constitution. It applies to you fully. Yeah. So when that is not happening for you, you then turn to the state and ask, excuse me?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
With entitlement.
Yes. It is your right.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what it says. We have a bill of what? Not maybe.
Yes.
It's rights.
Yes.
Yeah. And freedoms. So you're free to do these things.
Yes.
Yeah. You're free to associate with those your neighbors, even the nosy ones. You know, like.
Yes. Yes.
You have these rights. Yeah. Yeah. This is what we owe you. Because that's the social contract we have.
Yeah.
Right. And across African countries, I'm imagining they also have these social contracts with their states. You are entitled to those rights, freedoms, etc. as women. Yeah. So rooting these conversations, our gripes in our own realities as well, while still building transnational solidarity. So you're also not the be all end all. Yeah. You're not the first one to ever have gripe with these issues.
Yes.
So then you look at your neighboring countries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You look at them and you're like, okay, this is what we learned. Like, I learned a lot from NSARS, for example, in Nigeria, against police violence.
Yeah.
In Kenya, we've had sporadic protests and campaigns against police violence, but we haven't organized against it directly, like NSARS, which is a direct call to end SARS.
Yeah.
Right? We've organized against the president. We've organized against finance bills. We've organized against femicide. But there's a lot to learn from movements across the continent. So we root it here. And now we, like, flex that muscle. Like, keep saying that. Just keep flexing that muscle, learning, and then iterating. So we know that, oh, this is how we were intercepted last time. This is how they meddled with our movement last time. When we do a new one or we do a new campaign, we know what pitfalls to avoid.
I think that, and I love the use the NSARS example, because I'm thinking about their, and I haven't thought about this as much, but their mutual aid response and their legal aid response, we actually, I think, replicated in Kenya with a protest.
Yeah.
You know, LSK was phenomenal. That's the Law Society of Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
But the activation and the demand, because I think that's the other thing we have to remember, is institutions and people are responding to demands that citizens are making.
Yes.
And the demands that we're making are sometimes just, who are you in this moment, right? Like, so you happen to be in this position. Who are you in this moment? And I think it is so important that as we evolve our responses and our demands, because I think our demands also need to evolve, that we are not doing this in public. I think I've talked to you a little bit about this, how one of the things that I am especially resistant to is any fora that will have us talking about, how did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it means that you do not understand this moment. You know, as you've said, this is a critical moment.
Yes.
And we're organizing in an asymmetrical power. We are the ones who have significantly less power because the power has been hoarded by the state and is being exercised in ways that are contrary to legal dictates sometimes, and even the commitments of the state to its citizens. And so when you are in spaces, I would really encourage people who are doing this work not to speak about the how, speak about the what.
Mm.
you know.
These are my gripes. These are gripes. Yes. What we want.
And this is, you know, if you're interested in plugging in, plug in from where you are. This is how I've done it. So the example you give them is, this is who I am. So I often say, okay, so I'm a lawyer, I'm a political strategist, I'm a policy analyst. So I will engage with a look at an issue and I can maybe provide policy advice. Yes. I can give you, you know, I would approach this issue from this perspective. The framing is wrong. Mm. If you accept this framing, there's no way you're going to end up where you want to end up. Challenge the framing. So that's how I can engage. And in giving you the example of how I engage, I am telling you how you can do that as an IT professional, as a producer of a podcast, as, you know, an advertising professional who has, you know, amazing experience in framing messages and persuading people. So as much as possible, move away from the how and into the what, because the how, we really are in a place where people are mining information and trying to undermine and subvert movement. So I think that's an important thing. You've talked about state failure and we talked in the last episode and I really liked this and I really do hope you're going to do that doctorate.
Yes, I will.
Yes,
I have
to. Okay, good. talking about state capacity or incapacity and state failure and how in this moment of the poly crisis, that is presenting opportunities for the state to abdicate. And so what are some of the ways that we can try, which does go back a bit, I think, also to the mutual aid, which is how do we then try and hold the state accountable for its responsibilities? Mm. Or do we do away with states entirely?
So something that I really, really like in Kenya that's become more and more prevalent is strategic litigation, because that's one of the few things that the state takes seriously, right? In as much as it takes time, like it's costly, it takes time, it requires some very agentic people to to go and file, which Marilyn has done before, you know, congratulations to her. People like Marilyn, people like Okia Omtata and others who, you know, take it upon themselves, and we are really grateful for you. For me, once I am in a position to do that, like I plan to take all these people who put barriers on public roads to court, right?
Yes.
My friend, I'm just putting everyone on notice. Like it's a matter of me being very busy right now and not being able to sue all these residents associations that feel like, you know, they should put barriers on public roads, my friend. Like, it's a public road. But I'm grateful for people like you. But yeah, strategic litigation, so that we have it on the record.
Yes.
So that we have, because what a court case forces is a conversation.
Yeah.
Right? Because the media is going to cover it. They're going to say that, oh, yes, this case, this is how it's gone. It's at the High Court. This is what it said. And then should the state choose, can appeal, you know, which it does many times. It's like, the High Court has absolutely lost its mind.
Yep.
And if it's a constitutional matter, it would go all the way to the Supreme Court. We said that this is a matter of national importance, right?
Yep.
So it creates that necessity for conversation. And especially because I think in the Kenyan context, we are still defining what the realm of politics looks like. But we've become really good at the realm of law.
Yes, yes.
Yeah? We've become very litigious. Yeah, sometimes it's good. Sometimes not so much, because it prevents us from the conversation. Like, sometimes it's a political situation where we need to sit down and have these conversations, go through the unpleasantness, you know, of facing people and saying, I think this matters. And then other people saying, actually, we don't.
Yeah.
Right. And then both of both parties having to sit with the discomfort that that causes. Yeah. So strategic litigation, number one. Yeah. But of course, that is with, you know, full cognizance that we're not just speaking to Kenyan feminists in this case.
Yes.
We're speaking to the rest of the continent as well. So depending on how serious the courts in your country or your state are, and how much the government of the day, you know, plans to adhere to the rulings.
Yeah.
Another thing is direct action, as we've been doing, because there's nothing more frightening than a horde of citizens on the road or wherever they are, you know. You're just but one president, but one deputy, but 20-something cabinet secretaries, they are 3 million, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that one of the things that I really enjoyed in the aftermath of the June 2024 protest is that I could roundly declare that the government of Kenya, as it stands, is illegitimate. You do not look at that number of people on the streets saying you must go and continue staying and think
doing
you have
the same thing.
And think you have their mandate.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's madness. That's the realm of insanity. So the Kenyan government, like, the president knows it. We know it. You know, we don't have... Everybody knows. You know, you're here illegitimately, right? Like, yes, you won an election, but then the people went on the streets and stripped you of the legitimacy that they gave you en masse. So direct action is something very important. We've spoken about mutual aid. And I think something else is narrative work, because a lot of the work of politics is the conversation. Is it boring? Yes. Yeah? It can be extremely boring to revisit things that to you are a given.
Yes.
Like for me... trust me, there's nothing more annoying than the whole, should women, what do you mean? Like, should women X?
Yes.
I don't know, bro, should they?
Yeah.
Like, what are you asking?
Who's asking?
You know, who's asking? Yeah, but then, unfortunately, we live in a society, right? Mm-hmm. We live in a society.
It's that house and the dishes again,
exactly,
right?
It's the same dishes.
Yes.
And every day someone is learning about the thing for the first time.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Every day someone is hearing that stuff for the first time. So, unfortunately, this continues, mm-hmm. So, the narrative work, framing what we're doing in, like, on this podcast, for example, what we do on socials every day, same old conversation, but then, just remember, it's never the same people. Sometimes it is, because some people are crazy.
Yeah.
But, normally, it's not the same people asking the same questions all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And meeting people where they are. So something very entertaining. I used to be really against TikTok until like 2 years ago, where I found myself, and I was like, Kenyans on TikTok are hilarious,
Yes.
So finding them where they are, some of the conversations happening there have no chance. Okay, maybe they'll happen on the streets in like 2 years, but then some of them are really advanced, the arena for a conversation to be had that would normally not occur in real life, right?
Yeah.
So meeting people where they are, communicating with them in language that they understand, and knowing that, by the way, as someone who is, you know, prone to academia, there is space for academic language, there is space for that research, there is space for that really high-strung conversation, but then there is also space for intermediary or intermediate level conversation.
Yes.
And then there's space for basics, you know?
Yeah.
Bread and milk conversation.
Yeah.
Because we all be doing bread and milk. We all have
to
eat. So meeting people, and I think also injecting politics, and this is not electoral politics, just what we've said.
Yes.
Power relations and political conversation into everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just be that guy in your workplace. Be that person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be that person. And I think something else that we are not doing as much, and I think this is a generational thing. I'm a millennial, so, and it's a matter of disempowerment. It's active because governments have realized, or especially executives, presidents, they know the labor movement give them hell in the 70s and 80s. So we don't know the first thing about setting up a labor union.
Okay.
We don't know the first thing about joining. Mm-hmm. Like, what is that?
Yeah.
Who even joins?
Mm-hmm.
Who even joins the union of teachers? Other than, of course, teachers, right?
Yes.
But then we know how powerful those unions are. Yeah. I keep telling people, we have to find a way to organize as workers because the state knows workers. It recognizes workers.
Yeah.
If workers put their tools down, what's going to happen? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to tax?
Mm-hmm.
What they got? Like, the state stops, right?
Yeah.
So organizing formal institutions, and I know Maylin wanted to discuss this kind of institutionalization, formal institutions for workers, across, like, how do we take these gains that we've made as, you know, despite campaigns, movements, etc.,
then,
like, solidify them and then now build upon them?
Yeah.
Fortunately or unfortunately, that requires institutions, right? And I know one of the institutions that exists in the context of the continent is the NGO, right? So I'll hand
but
over to you.
Before you go to the NGOs and the institutions, I really think that this point that you've made about organizing workers is super important. And it requires some rethinking, especially in light of the gig economy and so many people not having formal employment. And again, it also goes back to community. You know, how we've talked about, this is not an individual struggle. As much as possible, you're going to hear, we talked in the last episode about, you know, arrested development, failure to launch. And, you know, I challenge these terms every time I hear them because I'm like, this is structural.
Yes.
This is not individual. And it's being presented to, you know, oh, mama, whoever, Mama James's son, you know, is still living at home at 32. And no one wants to have a real conversation about the fact that when he graduated from university, there weren't jobs available. And that's not his job. His job wasn't to create employment.
Right?
That was the state job, right? And once that job wasn't available, there were also very few volunteering opportunities and they were looked down upon. And, you know, entrepreneurship is not really something that we look upon as something that is worth it if you've had a proper education. This is the Kenyan and African context. It's changing a little bit, but it really wasn't, your parents didn't aspire for you to be an entrepreneur. I mean, I know when I came back to Kenya to start my business, my father was, oh, so sad. It's like, you have a law degree and you're starting a business. Like, what a failure. You know, it, to him, it was a sign of failure. It wasn't, you want to chart your own path. So there is a way that, and I'm speaking especially to younger people, millennials, but I think it also affects a lot of Gen X, because what it's doing is, and you talked about this, it's creating classes of people who are feeling out of place because they're unable to keep up with the expectations of society. But it's because society is not having an honest conversation about, are those still legitimate expectations?
Right.
You know, is it still legitimate to expect everybody to be employed when we know that there is a lack of foreign employment? And, oh, by the way, the state has policies that are actively disincentivizing entrepreneurship and the growth of enterprises, right? So they want to keep you at the kiosk level, right? So if you're just at the kiosk level, you're not going to be able to hire 5 employees or 10 or 15 or 20, you know? So I think it's important to remind people that these experiences, when they're made to be individual, are designed to keep you apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
That framing is, first of all, it's so that you can have a conversation with yourself about why you need capacity building. You don't, by the way. You know, you don't need to learn an extra thing, another thing, another thing, another thing. You have an environment that has been created by the state that is making it impossible for you to thrive.
Right.
And until you deal with that environment, you're not going to thrive. It's like asking a fish to thrive in sludge. I mean, you know, no amount.
Yeah, be real.
Yeah, it's not going to work. We have a problem with, or I think you used the example of a seed. Did you use that example?
Which one?
Of planting a seed, or that was not you, maybe. But it's the environment in which we're in that is actually poisoning us. So I think that's really important. I want to talk about strategic litigation for a bit, because I think the other thing to remember with strategic litigation is, go to court even if you're going to lose. You know, and you go to court, I think about, in Kenya's case, Justice Willy Mutunga had a dissenting opinion in 2012. There was an advisory opinion to the Supreme Court in 2012. And the question before the Supreme Court was, does the two-thirds gender rule, which requires not more than two-thirds of the members of a public elective body be of one gender, does it apply to the first election under the Constitution in 2013? And Willy Mutunga said, absolutely, of course it does, right? And that's his dissent. And he will be proved right by time, you know. Mm-hmm. I would hate to be one of the other justices who were in the majority opinion and who are just temporarily, you know, darlings of the state. So go to court, even if you're going to lose, because one of the things you get to do in strategic, especially public interest litigation, is you get to frame the issue. And what that does is you remove power from the state because you frame the issue the way you believe the issue should be framed. So, for instance, in Kenya, you know, one of the cases that we won but have never, ever in practice received was in 2016, we received a judgment which found that cabinet was unconstitutional if it doesn't meet the two-thirds gender rule. We've never had a cabinet that complies with the two-thirds gender rule. But, you know, I tell people, in the beginning, I was devastated because I was like, what the hell? Like, what is this worth? But for me, what it means is that one day somebody's going to go and challenge cabinet decisions because cabinet was illegally constituted.
Yes.
And that's trite law. That's basic. That's law 101.
Yes.
And they will succeed. And if they don't succeed, it will be because the courts will have to create these crazy exceptions that will allow illegality. So even losing is worth it.
Yes.
Because it it also allows you to exercise your agency. And again, you're exercising it in a forum where you believe that you have some power. So I choose strategic public interest litigation because I'm a lawyer and yes. I can frame issues, I believe, in a particular way that allows me to get particular thinking, even if not the result, because sometimes you want to force people to say the stupid thing, say it with their chest, not to hide. Go out and say, actually, we don't think a democracy requires that women are represented on equal numbers.
Yes.
Like, we think a democracy can function with minimal to no
women. A lopsided,
women.
Yeah.
Yes.
A lopsided representation.
Or structure. Like in South Africa, we think a democracy works if, you know, the majority are excluded. Like, force people to say that thing. So I just wanted to add that to the strategic public interest litigation. But I think that you've offered us a really great list of things to do. And they probably... and then we'll come to the NGO conversation now, because I think that's the sustainability component. But before that, I wanted to say that what that list of things does, I think, is also very powerful because it allows us to not think of ourselves as exceptional.
Yes.
Right? Humans have lived through crises before, will live through crises again, and we can make it through this moment. And I think it's part of the framing of the polycrisis is to make this so exceptional that, again, we're all paralyzed, right?
Yes.
And we can explain state paralysis because it's so big and so overarching. So the list of these practical things to do means that, no, actually, it's not that exceptional. It's doable. Mm. People have survived it before and we will survive it, right? So
I love that. I love that. Yeah, because like the dishes never end.
Yeah. We're still
There's
eating.
There's always going to be dishes.
There's always going to be dishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the work of washing dishes is never ending.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who does the dishes?
Yes.
Why do they need to be done? Should we buy a washing machine or rather a dishwasher, you know?
Yes.
And so like on a national level. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I think is the conversation on sustainability that we were talking about before. You brought up this very important point in the last conversation. And I was poo-pooing the role of NGOs and, you know, And you brought up a really important point about the sustainability of movements and one of the very important roles that NGOs have played. And I think you pointed to, which is what I'd like you to elaborate on today, you pointed to the role that they also can play in sustaining movements in a time of polycrisis, and especially on the African continent and with African feminists. And so that's what I wanted you to just sort of opine on.
Yeah, so just to, acknowledge the arguments against NGOs, because they are actually valid, and the people who dislike NGOs are, you know, they're justified, right? I have been one of them. I still am, like, this is literally just steel manning, you know, like the opposite of a straw man, you know?
Yes,
so just by the time you argue against something, you build like the strongest argument for it. And then, you know, now you deal with it. So the reason that they have been found to be insufficient is because, you know, one, they address the symptoms and not the disease, you know? And then second, you know, the funding is never long-term enough to sustainably address the issue.
Right.
So if you're getting funded on a 1 year cycle, maximum 3 years, meanwhile, you're dealing with a problem that would take 10 years to address, you know, acknowledge in a meaningful sense, then the fact that they still operate within extractive systems, right? So they look at the world as it is and say, okay, like, this is fine to us. This is how we are going to address it within the system, right? While people who would like to abolish or throw these oppressive systems out would, you know, refuse to accept that as the reality that we should propagate. And we've spoken about project cycles being a shorter term. And on the flip side, you know, polycrisis requires long-term commitment. This is actually one of the reasons we're not tackling the moment correctly, right?
Yes.
Governments are operating on their four-year election cycles. Others are being overthrown. Others are, you know, so the long-term planning that's required, you know? And then an organization or an institution like the United Nations that might have the muscle does not have, not the muscle, like the presence does not have the muscle, right?
Yes.
To do anything meaningful other than be sad, despondent.
They express,
you know, display, like, it's just a lot of emotional stern language, depending, you know, it's a range of a range of words. yeah, that are rarely followed up by necessary action.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem we are facing, right, with non-governmental organizations. Sometimes it's important to say the whole thing, right? It's just organizations that are operating outside of, it's not the government, right? So how do we reimagine this type of organization structure? So first I'd say, who's accountability to? And this is a conversation that's been had a lot within the feminist movement. We need NGOs to be accountable to the movements that they come from, right? Not just the donors. But then, of course, we know about power, right? Someone comes and gives you a $2 million grant. Let's see whether you wouldn't be singing their praises.
Right.
So this would also require some kind of seeding of power by these donor institutions or donor organizations or individuals, right? So you give people a grant and remember that their accountability is still to the movement.
To the
movement. So the movements have to become powerful, because power just doesn't, power doesn't just seed. You know, it doesn't just say, okay, I'm nice. You know, I'll give you $2 million and request nothing. You just do what you want. That's very rare. So the movements themselves have to be strong. And then NGOs have to also focus on redistribution, not just delivery, right? So a lot of it is like, we did, and then these were the outputs, and then these were the outcomes, and then, you know, some nice words about impact, because nobody funds you long enough for you to track long-term impact. So there has to be an attempt. And then the third thing I think is, how do we balance the need or this urge that they have to provide services that the state should be providing? Because they fail to provide those services, people die or people are hurt, right? So this is still a conversation I'm having with myself. And I'd encourage people to explore or read more about like what's been said. Because on the one hand, like I heard this from Jim Chuchu when they were premiering a docuseries that they're doing called Africa in the Anthropocene, saying that in the time that the USAID like programming in the continent has been paused or stalled, we've lost at least 600,000 lives on the continent. You see, so there's a real impact, right?
Yes.
When these kinds of programs are stopped, it's people die.
Yep.
So how do we balance this, right? The state is failing. We don't want NGOs to step in for this state that is failing. But then should they fail to step in, people die, right? So that's something that I'll ask all of us to sit with. I'm not purporting to have the answer. And then, of course, supporting grassroots organizing. Because a lot of the time, NGOs can use up or stand in for actual grassroots movements and what they're doing. Because, you know, you have a nice institution. It's a bit more polished. You know the right language. Those unwashed masses in God knows where, they can never talk to your donor like that. You know, like, there has to be, and this comes with accountability to movements, right? The work is being done by grassroots movements or grassroots activists, people organizing in the slum, in the neighborhood, wherever they're organizing, they have to be the center. And political solidarity as an organizing principle, not charity. So you're not doing, this is a framing thing. And also a mindset thing. You're not a charitable organization doing charitable, stop that. So think about it as you're expressing political solidarity to these, whoever you're, you know, supporting, wherever you're doing your programming, and finding ways to inject political framing or political topics in your work. That those are my initial thoughts.
I love that political solidarity, because political solidarity also means that we are your allies in the same way you are our allies. And that is exactly what the poly crisis is. If this is a global crisis, you are as invested as we are in reversing authoritarianism. You are as invested as we are in reversing the effects of the climate crisis. You are as invested as we are in ensuring that, you know, state incapacity is reversed and the normalization of state failure is challenged, right? Because once that's done here, it's more likely you can do it there, wherever you are, right? So I really love that about the political solidarity and that reframing of institutional support as part of political solidarity. So that brings us to the end of part two of our discussion on African feminisms and the poly crisis. Brenda, thank you so much for this.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
Sometimes
when you have to think through and articulate stuff, you know, it not forces, but encourages you you know, to sharpen and refine your position. So that has been a really useful thing for me.
And I have to admit that I think some of your optimism has rubbed off on me during this conversation. So.
And I hope the viewers as well.
Thank you. Yes.
There is no room for optimistic cynicism where we are going. Yeah. Can you imagine?
You need to be handing out, like, you know, sort of, you know, micro doses of hope.
I think I really, like, in another life, I could be like a non-denomination, no, a church, like, what are they called? Pastors, but not for like religion.
Sorry, Brenda, that'd probably be a cult.
Yes.
It would be a good cult, though, I'm pretty sure.
A good one, a good one. They hear that you've joined them, like, jail them. All they want to do is, you know, change political
and make people happy. So thank you so much, viewers, for joining us. As I said, this is a project of the House of African Feminisms that is supported by the Goethe Institute. And I want to thank them for their support of African feminisms and African feminist conversations on the continent. We will actually be airing this podcast, which is in conversation with other podcasts that are hosted by African feminists from around the continent. And we're super grateful for their support of African feminists and grateful to them as an institution, but also grateful to the feminists within the Goethe Institute for the feminist solidarity. Because again, as we've spoken about, political solidarity is important, but so is feminist solidarity. And it comes through in funding like this that allows us to have conversations that amplify the voices of African feminists. So thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the holiday season.
Yes, thank you.